You're listening to the Hello World Podcast, number 83. My name is Sean Wildermuth, and I am your host. The Hello World Podcast is where you can hear from some of your favorite developers, authors, and speakers about how they got started in this business and the decisions they made along the way. We go way back to their first computer, first code experience, and their first job. With this episode, it only leaves 17 episodes left. Yes, we're ending the podcast after 100 episodes. The last episode will be Richard Campbell interviewing me about how I got started. Can't wait for you to hear it. Decided not to have a sponsor for the podcast, but if you want to support the podcast and the kinds of things that I do, feel free to visit my Pluralsight courses at seanw.me/psauthor, including my newest course on implementing and securing an API with ASP.NET Core. On today's show, we have Jeff Atwood. Jeff Atwood considers himself a reasonably experienced Windows software developer with a particular interest in the human side of software development, as represented in his recommended developers reading list on his blog, Coding Horror. Computers are fascinating machines, but they're mostly a reflection of the people using them. In the art of software development, studying code isn't enough. You have to study the people behind the software, too. I've been a fan of Jeff's writing for I don't know how long now. It was really nice to finally meet him and get a view into that head of his to see how he ticks. So if you follow Jeff on Twitter or read his blog, I think you're going to get a lot out of this show. Let's take a listen. So I'm really happy to have Jeff Atwood on the show today. How are you doing, Jeff?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've been really excited about having you on the show. We're winding down to our last few shows, so I was lucky enough that you had the time.
Yeah, let's go with a bang.
So I don't know whether you know the format of the show, but we're most interested in how you got started. So did you have a computer growing up, or was this something you got interested in college?
I had video game systems. So I this was the era of the Atari 2600, the Intellivision. So if you're of a certain age, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And I had an Atari 2600, and I, of course, wanted all these other systems. I wanted, like, every video game system there was, because what kid didn't really?
Yeah.
And I was so super into video games and arcades and all that stuff. And my dad kind of refused. He's like, no, I'm not going to get you another video game system. I'm going to get you a computer. And he said, then you can write your own games. Such a dad thing to say, right? Like, oh, God. And I have to go do work because my dad wants me to, you know, like, mow the lawn and stuff. So
you've made my joy into a job. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was like, fine, whatever. And so we bought a computer. The first computer we got was the Coleco Atom. So it was a transitional system. It was kind of a weird system if you look into it.
Yeah.
And it's funny because they had, for a long time, I think they still have it, they have AtomCon. And I thought this was weird in like 2003 when I discovered it. And it's even weirder that it's still going on in 2017. But look it up. It's like AtomCon. So people still run these old computers. And this is a very obscure computer, too. It's like they said, okay, it's ColecoVision, which is a video game system that I had. But we're going to turn it into a full-blown computer. So it had some desultory way of connecting to the ColecoVision. But it had like tape drives. It had a daisy wheel printer that was like literally the loudest printer that has ever existed in a human house, because it was like, it was so loud I had to throw a towel over it when I was printing.
Wow.
It was definitely loud.
And the daisy wheels are essentially giant typewriters that plugged in, right?
Yeah. So it wasn't doing dot matrix. It wasn't like, you know, synthesizing characters. It was like a fixed wheel of characters. And we just like, you know, smack the right character onto the paper. So it was kind of a weird, primitive, like transitional console system, but I really got into it. I mean, that my dad was really correct about what I was going to enjoy and what I would like. And then from there, I got really fed up. I got really good at fixing the tape drives, because the tape drives would occasionally just unspool and break. Well, not really. I guess break's not the right word, but the tapes would come unspooled.
Yeah.
This was the earliest form of like data recovery disaster that you can think of. You know, it's like, oh my God, all my programs, everything I've written. Cause like, where was it going to back stuff up? You know?
Right.
I guess I could back it up on multiple. I don't know if I even had multiple tapes, to be honest. I might've had just the one tape that I stored everything on. Cause I think those were hard to buy as well. Cause it's like a proprietary tape drive.
Oh really?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't think it was like any standard format. I think it was some special data tape you had to have. It wasn't like you just slap any, you know, your Motley Crue album in there and start recording over it with data.
Oh, interesting. Cause on my Vic 20, it was regular like tapes. The ones that when it would unspool, you would find the pencil and then spin it around, hopefully not ruining it.
Yeah. So I got really good at like fixing the tape drive and, you know, writing code, debugging code. And I did end up writing some games that were, I thought fairly sophisticated for the time. But I really enjoyed the process, obviously, of programming. I mean, that part my dad was right about.
So and was this using BASIC or?
Yeah, it was a variation of everything in Microsoft BASIC in those days. So it was another form of Microsoft BASIC. But I grew to really resent that system because, you know, it wasn't really AppleSoft BASIC. It wasn't like a major BASIC. It was some weird, you know, Coleco brand BASIC. And so from there, we went in a couple different directions. From there, we got a TI-99/4A, which is the Texas Instruments computer, which I also could program and wrote some games for that.
And is that the one that had the bubble keyboard, or did it have a real keyboard?
That one actually had a real keyboard, so that wasn't bad. And so did the Atom. The Atom had a decent keyboard, actually.
Really?
It wasn't a trashy keyboard, at least. The keyboard part was nice. Yeah.
And were games mostly what you continued to write on these computers?
Mostly, yeah. Yeah, I would play the built-in, you know, cartridge games, and then I would, you know, write my own crappy, terrible version of games or come up with similar games or game ideas and, you know, build it up in those primitive BASIC variants. That's pretty much what I spent most of my time doing with those two systems.
And did you figure out pretty quickly that programming was sort of the, you know, what you wanted to do as a job and such, or was that just not in your mind yet?
I was clearly super into it. Like, there was something about the computer that really sucked me in, you know, that the fact that it was its own little self-contained world. And then, you know, a little bit later than that, I think what really sucked me in was really the modem, you know, getting a modem. I didn't have a modem for either one of those.
Right.
So I had no way of, like, you know, talking to other people or talking to other computers. But eventually I got into the Apple because after working with those two systems, I began to understand why you wanted to own one of the major computers, because there was just so much more stuff for it, you know.
Right.
The TI and the Coleco were just very, really fairly obscure systems. I mean, not super obscure. People owned them, but they weren't like the big three, you know, right, that people owned at the time. So I eventually convinced my dad to pay the Apple tax, and we got an Apple IIc, which is another weird variant within the Apple system. It's their portable Apple computer. I don't know why. I think it was just cheaper. It wasn't that it was portable. It was interesting because I never really took it anywhere.
Sure.
Outside my room. And it had this weird display that was like a basketball backboard. It kind of hung, had like a little stand where it would kind of hang there.
Oh, really?
And the system itself was compact. It didn't have slots, which I also grew to resent, because a lot of the cool stuff, the Apple IIe, this is before the Mac. So Apple was still into sort of upgradability and modding and all that stuff. All considered the Steve Wozniak values of the company,
right,
are represented in the Apple. So there's a lot of stuff you could do with the 2E. You could put in like these crazy cards that would do stuff. There was one that was really popular called the Apple Cat, which was a modem card and the killer feature it had was you could double your bandwidth because you could send and receive at the same time with this card. Plus, there were programs that while you were sending and receiving, you could still chat with the other person, which was huge. Yeah, it was amazing at the time. It was like, holy crap. You could send all your, you know, programs back and forth, air quote programs, you know. Yes. We're really trading pirate programs at that point. But you could send and receive at the same time. Plus, you could chat. And it was a really cool-looking program because you could see the data going across, like the raw data represented in ASCII format. So it just looked super cool. It was like the Matrix before there was the Matrix, was the Apple Cat. So, of course, I couldn't get that because I had just a regular Hayes, external Hayes modem, the classic. Yeah. If you know what modems look like, there was this classic Hayes modem with the silver body, the black front with the red LEDs, super classic design. So I had the 1200 Hayes 1200. And the other funny thing about the Apple IIc is when I got it, so I got, I think, let's say I got a 300 watt modem because, yeah, and that ended up being brutal because I quickly learned I could read faster than 300 baud.
You can, yes.
And I was like, oh God, you know, because 1200 baud was a thing. It was just more expensive. And the 2C shipped with a bug in the serial part of the motherboard where every so often it would just garbage would get inserted into the stream. It was like literally a hardware bug. You can look this up. There's still documentation on because I looked it up. I was curious. And I thought that was normal. As a kid, I was like, oh, maybe this is normal because I had never really used a modem before.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, maybe there's just noise on the line or, you know, that's just the way this works. You know, there's occasionally garbage on the screen. And I was like, oh, I guess that's normal. And I eventually realized, talking to people online, they're like, what are you talking about? Why is there garbage on your screen? I was like, I don't know. My screen has all this garbage. I thought it was like line noise or something. And it turned out it was a hardware bug. So we had to, you know, Apple had to fix that part of the motherboard. They had some fix they shipped to the dealers. And,
wow.
Yeah,
I actually had the same experience in that I had a bad phone cord, but I just assumed you had to refresh a message and sort of read between the garbage to figure out what a message was on a bulletin board. And that lasted like 6 months. No one clued me in at all. And then I think it was my cat bit through it or was chewing through it. So I replaced it and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Is this how everyone else experiences it?
Yeah, at this time, so just to put it in frame of where I was as a human being, the earlier computers were like middle school. And then once I started getting to high school, that's when I had the Apple. That was like 8th, 9th grade.
And did the Apple IIc have lowercase letters?
It did.
Okay.
Yeah, the 2E and then I think the older Apple II had no lowercase. But at that point, people had switched mostly to the 2E and beyond.
Yeah, because I remember being on bulletin boards and everyone, you knew they were using an Apple because they were yelling, but at some point that switched over.
Yeah. Yeah. At the time I was getting into it, that was, people knew about it, but there was definitely lowercase. And the 2C actually had an 80 column display, which was, I think an upsell on the 2E.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's special to get 80 columns, but the 2C had that built in, which was nice.
A whole 80 columns.
I remember because I played Wizardry and Wizardry wasn't written. It was sort of predated that, the original Wizardry, which is a very, very famous RPG. Mm-hmm. I played it a fair bit. I don't think I finished it, but I got really far. One thing that was weird about it was like after every character, there would be a space like on the screen. It was like Wizardry and everything. I was like, why is it doing this? And I realized it was because it was written for 40 columns and it was playing in 80 columns. So it did that by like alternating spaces because it wasn't written to handle that.
That's funny.
Yeah. So that was just a quirk of it. Still worked and everything. It just looked very spaced out. Because it's written for 40 column displays. I got heavily into modem stuff at that time.
And then, of course, run your own BBS?
I did briefly. I got my parents to get a second phone line. I don't know how I could talk them into that. And then I dabbled with, but I only had a 2C, so I couldn't really do any of the fancier stuff. And I think at one point I ran a BBS where like I had to like manually answer every call.
Right.
I don't know what I was thinking, but I was just a kid, you know, I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to understand this too online when you're looking at interacting with people online. Sometimes you're legitimately interacting with kids. A lot of times you're acting with adults that are just behaving like children.
Sure.
But there's a lot of legit kids online that are just like, they don't know. They're just figuring stuff out, right? Like, so it is important to sort of ascertain someone's age and understand like they're still in the process of figuring it out. Cause a lot of that early stuff, I just really shake my head. I was like, what was I thinking? You know, I wasn't really, I was just a kid.
Oh yeah. You were 13. Not.
Yeah. I didn't know what I was doing. So, but I love the modem stuff. I loved, CompuServe. I loved all the local BBSs.
Do you remember your CompuServe number?
74. I not really.
Okay.
I don't. I don't. Unfortunately.
One of those things I'm always hoping someone will remember. I think there's been one person on the podcast that remembered it, but I don't remember who it was.
Nice. That's impressive. Actually, if you remember your I would be impressed. If
yeah,
remember
I was. That. I was.
A little CompuServe number.
So as you got out of high school, did you pursue this through college or did you get a job? How did that transition look like?
I did it all through high school and I really, really liked it. I mean, I was super into it. And I think at the end there, I switched over to the Amiga because it was about the time when the Amiga came out. The Apple 2GS came out. I remember calling Apple. The day the 2GS came out, we called Apple to get details on it. Like, we literally used our, you know, and also, by the way, when we talk about calling and all this stuff, you had to be what's known as freaking, which is trying to get free long distance service.
Yeah.
Because it was so expensive to make long distance calls at that time. And this is something that's rightfully, I think, forgotten, because you don't think of phone calls as like that cost anything anymore. Right.
Yeah. You know, even within a state, you know, calling to a different area code was a long distance call.
Yeah, it was crazy how expensive it was. And I was just a kid, so I couldn't afford that. So there were all these nefarious things you'd have to do to freak. And I actually wrote programs that would what's called war dialers, which is where you would there were services that would let you dial out with codes, you know, and make long distance calls. You would call this number and then enter a code and then your number. And so if you had the code, you could do it for free. And some of them had codes that weren't that long, like 4 digits, or they were enough that you could sort of brute force them. So I wrote a war dialing program that would do that. And I wrote on my blog about this, but I actually got in trouble. I got kind of caught for that. And,
oh, wow.
There was I had to go to court and all kinds of, I wrote about it on my blog. So it's not like a secret or anything, but it was definitely illegal. And it was because you had to kind of get your fix. It's like, how do you call long distance? Because all the cool BBSs were, I was in Virginia at the time, and there were a few BBSs that were good, but all the really awesome BBSs were not in my area code.
Right.
The ones you really wanted to be on for trading software and for talking to people were in other area codes. So there was a lot of time spent on freaking. And once that happened, that was right before I went to college, luckily. So that didn't intersect anything. And ultimately, you know, like we plea bargained, and, you know, it was ultimately okay. I stopped, obviously, doing that. And nothing bad came of it. But I by that time, I had kind of switched to the Amiga and was doing most of my programming on the Amiga. So the computer I brought with me to college was, I think I sold, I had an Amiga 1000, which was the expandable Amiga, the large original Amiga system. And I sold that and brought the Amiga 500, which is a smaller system, thinking, oh, I'll bring the small portable Amiga with me. But once I got to college, I kind of tried to get a little bit out of computing. I still had it there. I still had games and stuff. And
sure.
I definitely took computer classes and stuff in college. But my attitude was I wanted to have the full college experience. I don't want to, you know, have my nose in front of a computer all the time like I did in high school. So I tried to de-emphasize that part of my life during college. And I, for the most part, I did. I still did stuff. I still had – I remember one point I bought a cheap IBM PC portable clone with some terrible LCD display. I was messing with that. So it was always kind of there, but I kind of pushed it more to the background.
Well, did this coincide with wanting to meet girls? Because being the computer guy was never a plus in that arena.
Yeah, that's true. And gosh, we talk about like gender balance today, but then, wow.
Yeah.
It was extremely rare to meet any women that did girls or women that did computer stuff. Man, that was unbelievably rare.
Yeah.
That was part of it. And I think also I just wanted to have a real college experience. I mean, college is a big deal. And I went to the University of Virginia, which is a fairly good public college. So I just wanted to, you know, sort of make the most of my experience. And so I kind of pushed that part of my life a little bit to the background. It was always there, but it wasn't sort of the focus like it definitely was in high school.
And so what did you major in?
I had a major in two things. I majored in environmental science with a minor in computer science, because the computer science stuff, I mean, conceptually, I wanted to, you know, take a step back from it anyway. And it was made easier at the time, the University of Virginia, I heard they changed this, but at the time I was there, which would be the very late 80s, the computer science department was part of the engineering school, which was extremely rigorous. I mean, you had to take physics, you had to take advanced calculus, you had to take some pretty hardcore classes that were, and I never thought of myself as an engineer. I was more of an English language guy. I wasn't
sure.
I was pretty soft in terms of, you know, I love to read, you know, and I love to write. And those were the things that I really enjoyed, not so much hardcore maths, right?
Right.
So I was like, wow, this is not going to work for me, because all you heard from the engineering school was like horror stories of how difficult it was and people dropping out, and that terrified me. So I found later what I was able to do is take the engineering school classes, you could still take those classes from the outside, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I would do is just take, like, pick and choose the computer classes that I wanted. And then my environmental science major was, you know, it was science. So we were still doing research and data and all that stuff, which I did enjoy. But it was a softer side of the science that wasn't quite so hardcore in the maths. And sure. that worked well. And I actually, another thing I wrote about my blog that's really cool is, do you know the last lecture guy, Randy Pausch? That guy who did the last lecture? Have you heard about this?
I have.
I actually had him as a teacher.
Wow.
And yeah, it was really cool because I always remember he was such an amazing teacher. He was my algorithms class teacher. And for the longest time, people would ask me, it would come up occasionally. It's like, well, what'd you learn in college that you really brought forward? And the funny thing about college is you don't really – there's no one thing you bring forward from college in my experience. And I talked to people that have gone to MIT and other really fancy colleges. They kind of said the same thing. It's like, what you say, what do you use now in your job that you learned in college? And their answer was like, well, nothing, which is true.
Yeah.
So, but when they said this to me, I would say, you know – nothing specifically I bring forward with me, but the process of learning how to learn is so critical. And my algorithms class was really useful. We were talking about like big O notation and like how you write code and like how you structure code to understand just the built-in speed limits of what you're doing, like at the physics level almost, like how complex is the problem you're trying to attack. And I always loved this class. I felt it was my best class. And it was because it was Randy Pausch and he was such a good teacher.
Wow.
I didn't connect this until years later when I was thinking, I was like, oh, Randy Pausch was at University of Virginia. And then I was like, wait a minute. He was at the University of Virginia when I was at the University of Virginia. And then I was like, wait a minute. I had that really good teacher who taught algorithms. And I looked it up and I cross-referenced it. And it was absolutely Randy Pausch, right?
Wow.
I didn't remember the name and stuff because, like, I don't know. It's hard to remember all this stuff. But I cross-referenced it and absolutely. He was teaching when I was there. He was teaching this class when I was there. So that was kind of cool. To have that experience, because I did always remember that. And it's a hallmark. One thing you learn in college that I thought was very cool is it doesn't even matter what the subject is sometimes. What matters is if the teacher is really good, then they can make literally any topic interesting. And I believe that is deeply true. You know, forget so much about learning specific. You must learn X, Y, and Z. It's like just learn how to learn, you know, learn how to get along with other human beings. That's a valuable skill.
Mm-hmm.
Learn how to live like away from your parents. That's a valuable life skill. And also being surrounded by other people that are kind of going places in life, that are doing things, not just sitting home eating Cheetos all day. There is some truth in those statements now that I have kids. Like I see the truth in these statements. You want to be around other people that are like doing stuff, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I had a wonderful time in college. I mean, you know, and probably the highlights were I still had the Amiga most of the time. I don't think I switched to IBM at that point yet. Yeah. And then the Amiga really was one thing I carried with me.
That's awesome. And did you start working in environmental science leaving college, or did you find yourself programming?
After I got out of college, We went to Colorado because we were into mountain biking and we were like, okay, me and my group of friends were like, we're graduating from college. We don't really know what to do. Let's just go to Boulder, Colorado because it's a cool place and there's a lot of mountain biking. So we did. And then while we're there, it's like, well, I need to make money. So I was thinking, well, what do I know that, you know, is easy for me to make money with? And it turned out like being skilled with computers was something that was easy to make money doing.
Yeah.
So I got involved and that's when I got into the IBM world heavily. Like I had stopped looking at IBM because it wasn't really the cool computer at all when I was growing up, right?
Sure.
It was the corporate computer that didn't really have good games. It didn't really have good sounds. It didn't have good graphics. It wasn't fancy in terms of architecture. It was a very basic machine. It wasn't like the TRS-80, which is, you know, the trash 80 everybody thought was a joke. It wasn't a joke computer, but it was just boring. So when I got out of college, Windows 3.0 was out. And I remember using Windows 3.0 and thinking, you know, this isn't bad. Like, this is actually pretty cool. Coming from Amiga and Workbench and all that fairly sophisticated GUI stuff that they had for the day.
Yeah.
They had like multitasking and like a Unix-like operating system. It was fairly sophisticated. So I remember looking at Windows going, you know, this is not bad. Like, I expected to hate it. And I was like, no, this is going somewhere decent. So I got heavily into Windows at that point. I was like, okay, Windows is cool, right? And plus, I needed it for my job. Sure. All the systems there were Windows systems. And I did really database programming was kind of what I did. I got into Fox Pro. But I love databases. I always thought they were fascinating because you know, the backbone of any program is data. You got this data and you got to be able to do something with it. And then I learned SQL and I was like, oh, SQL is so cool. There was like a really basic form of SQL in Fox Pro. And I learned SQL and I just really enjoyed database stuff. I enjoyed writing boring CRUD database apps. I had never done that before. So to me, it was like, wow, this is cool. Like today, I would probably slit my throat if I had to write a basic CRUD app, you know, of just keeping track of data. But back then, it was like really cool. And Fox Pro for its time was sophisticated. It was very fast, very mature at that point. There was Fox Pro for Windows that had just come out. And I had tons of fun writing with Fox Pro. I mean, to me, that was my intro into databases.
Nice. And was that the first time you were actually working with other people, or was this sort of a, you know, like, go build this one quick thing so I can get back to mountain biking?
You know, that's a good point. For a long time, I was the one guy who was writing code. It wasn't like I had to work with other programmers. It was a small business that I was working for, mm-hmm. so I was kind of the uber geek computer guy.
Sure.
And towards the end of my interaction with them, they hired some other company to do some work, and I kind of handed stuff over to them. And I remember thinking that these people weren't as smart as I was, and I was such a great programmer, they're not going to be able to handle. But it took a while. That's a good point. I eventually ran in with another guy who ran a consulting company, and indirectly, I learned a lot from him because he was another programmer. And I remember sitting with him writing Fox Pro apps, and then he would do this thing where he would take my Fox Pro for Windows app and test it, you know, and being that I had never had anyone test my code, he would find like five or six things immediately that were like, oh, if I enter this, your program crashes, or if I do this. And I was like, well, why would you do that? Why would you enter this bad invalid input? And he's like, no, you don't understand. Like, this is how you test. And eventually I came around to his way of thinking, which was your code has to be correct. You know, like, you have to cover all these cases, even if you think no one will hit them, and just think ahead of all the weird situations you're going to get into and try to anticipate that both in the UI and the code and all that stuff.
And users will do it.
Yeah, some users will, because we were writing stuff for more than internal use at that point. We were like, sure, selling a product, and the audience was kind of expanding for my code. But that was my first time working actually with another programmer, and I learned a lot from that guy. His name was Bill O'Neill. Kind of wonder. I've tried to look him up, but his name is so generic that it's like impossible to find him.
That's always tough.
Yeah, but I learned a lot, and I had a new respect at that point for, you know, learning stuff from other programmers. I was like, wow, this definitely made me better, and got me to a place I wouldn't have gotten by myself.
Was there any hesitation to being around other programmers? Because as being sort of the one uber geek, is there any fear that it was sort of like being found out, or were you just that confident?
I just really, really love this stuff. And I don't want to say I was, you know, cocky, but like I felt that was very good.
Sure.
And that, but again, my sample size was really small. You got to realize, like, this was before the internet. The problem with the internet is, no matter how good you are at something, now it's trivial to find somebody that's like 10, 50 times better than you are because you're connected to the whole world now. But in the old days, when you weren't actually connected to every person on the planet, it was easier to be in a bubble where you felt really good, you know, because I've never met anyone that's as good as I am, or I've never met anyone that's, you know, even close as good as I am at this stuff.
Sure. And especially if you're in the business office with sales guys or whatever, and they can't change the paper in the printer, you know, sometimes it really makes you feel good.
Yeah, exactly. You're not working at a software company. You're working at some company where, you know, you're the one person who does software stuff. But I did interact with other programmers. That guy, Bill, who was great. And then he hired, I want to say, two other programmers. It was never really a big shop. Sure. Most maybe people on him. And I remember, you know, working them through the code and helping them at times figure stuff out. There was a little bit of pair programming at that time, but I think the audience was just so small for that stuff at the time. You had to really wait for the internet to hit for a lot of other stuff to happen.
And did you ever move into running teams or leading teams or in a more formal way, maybe in a software company, or were you always, you know, pretty much in small companies?
I'm trying to think of the sequence at that point. We moved a couple times. I met my wife in 1993. Yeah, because I remember reading all about Windows 95. This is how geeky I am. Like, I think about when I met my wife, and it's like, it's the time when I was waiting for Windows 95 to come out. I was reading all about it, how big it was going to be. And it was really a big deal. Windows 95 was a very transformational product for the industry, right?
Yeah.
It sort of closed the gap with the Mac and kind of brought the Windows into the modern era where it's remained ever since, really.
So people around forget that people lined up to buy it like they do iPhones. I mean, it was.
I remember going to a movie theater. They had some like preview program. You go to a movie theater and they screen some movie about like Windows 95. I remember going there with a bunch of other geeks and like just sitting there geeking out about Windows 95. I remember some guy came in on a motorcycle. He was Indian, like American Indian, and he was the localization expert. Like he helped with internationalization, and they talked about that. So you were really learning. I mean, think about when was the first time you thought about internationalizing an app you wrote, right? Yeah. At the time, I was like, holy crap, cool. You can write an app that, you know, is in 50 different languages like they do at Microsoft, where they build, you know, giant software. So at that time, I think I was just transitioning into just different small companies. And one of the contracting companies that I had worked with through Bill did 911 software. Eventually went to work for that company.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, which was interesting because, like, you know, public safety. And it's kind of laughable in retrospect that we were building this public safety software. I mean, I did my best. Like, our product was reasonable, but I don't know, man. In retrospect, it was kind of scary to be buying products from this company that I was writing code for. It's just the engineering wasn't really up to spec.
Yeah, and that literally people's lives were on the line. And but when you were writing the code, were you thinking, you know, sort of what we're doing? It has that sort of impact. We have to be more careful, or
it did teach me about the impact, right? Like I did learn, you know, this stuff has to work, not just because it's correct from an engineering perspective, the right thing to do, but because people rely on your software to not fail. So I did learn a lot about resilience and, you know, long, like, will this program run for 7 days on the computer?
Right.
And then I had to write some server-side stuff, which I hadn't done before, because we had like client and server sort of architecture for this application. It's 911 application. I learned a lot from that. I learned about queues. Like that was probably my first time I had implemented like a real queue, because I remember working through the server side thinking, oh God, you know, the server may not be able to catch up with all these requests. So what do I do? And I was like, oh my God, a queue. I was like, I can finally use something for my algorithms class. And it worked. It was great because I had these problems of sequencing, and then I put in the queue and I was like, wow, now it's great. As long as you don't get too far behind for too long, you're always covered. You're not going to lose anything.
Right. Right.
So I did some client server. I also did a little bit of Delphi. I was doing Visual Basic at that time. I switched to Visual Basic from Fox Pro. And from there, I had to write some low-level interface to serial stuff, and I just could not do it from Visual Basic. So I finally wrote it in Delphi, which was Anders Helsberg, am I pronouncing that incorrectly? The C-sharp guy. That was his product, basically. That was Turbo Pascal taken to the future, and it was a great, great product. But it was as close as I've ever gotten to C programming. I always envied the C programmers because I felt like I just couldn't – I wasn't really smart enough to deal with pointers and C. Like, I just couldn't – and I always kind of hated the syntax. I know it's sacrilege to say this kind of stuff, but I hated the C syntax. I hated case sensitivity. Uh-huh. So Delphi was like a little window into like, yes, I could write low-level code. You know, it was a little more structured. Like today would be clear into like Rust or Go, you know.
Right.
Wow. It's like C, but like nicer, like more humane.
I always liked Delphi in that you could tell when an app was written in Delphi because it had 34 different colors on the UI. I don't know what it was about Delphi, but people love changing colors.
Delphi also had a very distinct set of OK buttons, like a set of visual designs, so you could kind of tell. And, you know, even today, I think some Windows products are still built using Delphi because it was truly low level. I mean, you could build C competitive code with Delphi, no question. You could build like real commercial apps with Delphi. So I think there's still a group of companies out there building on these with their products.
There's certainly still user groups for it.
Yeah.
There's probably I was talking to a friend of mine, and he insists that it's Delphi, not Delphi. And I'm like, I'm not changing.
It might be. I've heard it pronounced both ways. It's kind of like SQL versus SQL. It's like, you know, there can be two. It's not, you know, like GIF versus JIF, where it's a, you know, religious argument either way.
Always is. And so how did it, the idea of starting to blog, you know, obviously you're a, you know, I don't want to say a super famous blogger, but I think that's an accurate representation. Was it that love of writing that sort of went, I need an outlet for this?
So that's a little bit further forward. So starting about year 2000, I had taken a different job at a much larger company, a drug company, GlaxoSmithKline, where it was more working in structured environments, writing code, using version control, that sort of thing. That was probably the first company that I'd used version control at. I know it sounds depressing and sad, but at small companies before the year 2000, I think if you were using version control, you were quite advanced.
Absolutely.
No question. I mean, it's amazing, actually, if you think back how far we've come in engineering as software engineers since even the year 2000.
Yeah.
In terms of the norms and the internet. But at that point, I was working for GlaxoSmithKline, working with other programmers. And I noticed that I love programming more than the other programmers there. Like, it was kind of their job. Mm. But to me, it was like a lifestyle. It was like, wow, I really like this stuff. Like, I just love thinking about it. I love learning about it. I love writing about it. I love everything about it, right? And they didn't. And it wasn't a negative reflection of them. It was just I had this perversion where I really, really wanted to learn this stuff. And it was hard for me to have people to talk to about this stuff. So that's when I started the blog in 2004. Is like, okay, this is my outlet. This is my research notebook for everything I'm learning about programming and all the books I'm reading and all the stuff I'm figuring out. I'll just write about it on my blog. Cause by that point I had started to see blogs show up in my search results.
Sure.
So I wasn't thinking, oh, a blog is like a diary. You know, how lame is that? It's just a diary, right, on the internet. It was more like, wow, I'm getting really useful search results from blogs. These are, you know, people writing about things that are happening to them as programmers that are helping other programmers and helping themselves. And I said, I want to do that because that's exactly what I was trying to do. I didn't have anyone to talk to.
Sure.
So I'll just talk to the world. and I did. It was like January 2004. It was the Janet Jackson nipple event, Super Bowl, if you want to put yourself in the right time frame. That's roughly when I started the blog. And yeah, that worked really well, obviously. But
that wasn't primarily an outlet to just, you wanted to be able to share what you were learning, but also you wanted to kind of have this contributing to the knowledge that was out there in the internet. I mean, was it sort of this need to or desire to teach as well?
I think it was a desire to leave sort of useful stuff out there.
Sure.
I saw that it wasn't, like I said, like a diary where it's like, how is this going to be useful to anyone? You know, dear diary, Here's what I did today. It's like, who cares? How is that useful? It was leaving these artifacts that were really useful. And that's what convinced me to do it. And, you know, I had a New Year's resolution in 2004. I was like, okay, I'll write a blog entry every day. And that was pretty aggressive. Of course, they were shorter blog entries back then.
Sure.
But I did for a while write every day. And then I was like, okay, every weekday. And then I kept that up for quite a long time. So I had a schedule that I was trying to stick to.
Wow.
And I recommend that if you're starting out, like, you have to have a schedule. It's like exercise. You're not doing it for other people. You're doing it for yourself.
Yeah.
That's so important to understand that it's about you primarily, first and foremost. And the utility to other people comes in time and comes as you do stuff. Like, some blog entries are really popular and some aren't. And you never know what's really going to work for yourself and for others unless you do it. So, you know, that's the process, right?
And sometimes for me, blogging is, I figured out this difficult series of things that I have to do to accomplish something. And I'm going to forget where that notebook is. So if I write it on the blog, because I super have Googled something and found my blog entry and had to read my blog entry to figure something out. I don't know if it's just because I don't have any memory left. I'm getting to that age, but it did surprise me to, like, oh, I once knew how to do this.
Yeah, for sure. And then the surprising thing you'll find is, you just write stuff down so you can remember it. Like, I go back to my old blog entries all the time.
Absolutely.
Because I'm trying to remember what I did, how I did it, why I did it. And I read my blog and go, oh yeah, that's why I did that.
Absolutely.
That's, you know. And I think that's the best mindset. It's more like a research notebook. Yeah. It's not so much a diary. It's more like, here, this is my research notebook of stuff I've done and stuff I've tried. Like as a scientist, you would write down that kind of stuff. So it's more like science at that point.
Yeah.
And the skill of writing is so critical. I mean, being able to communicate, that's sort of the secret value of Stack Overflow, is it's teaching you how to communicate with other programmers. If you can write a really great answer that's short, concise, to the point, has a good example, explains what's going on, explains the caveats, right? Because everything has caveats. There's no one perfect way to do something. There never is. There's always more than one way to do it, as they say in Perl. So deeply true.
Yeah.
But if you can write in a clear way, I mean, that's competitive advantage in life for you, not just on Stack Overflow, but in everything you're going to do for the rest of your time on this planet as a human being.
Absolutely. I also see my experience with Stack Overflow has been what I've stolen from Chris Sells is the teddy bear story, where some people call it the rubber ducky, where you have to explain something to somebody else, and it is enough structured understanding of the real problem that you figure it out. I think probably half the questions on Stack Overflow I've written, I've never pushed publish on, because I figured it out, you know, as I'm trying to communicate it to somebody else. Really forces me to look at it, you know, without, you know, I just want to get this done shortcut sort of mindset.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And this is where people complain that Stack Overflow is so strict about what we'll accept. It's like, by the time you write the question, because you know that Stack Overflow is kind of strict about what we will accept, is that you've done the work to explain the problem, you know, walk through the problem, document the problem. And then you get to the end and go, oh, wait a minute, I realize the solution to my problem. The act of writing it down in a structured format and explaining it in detail such that another person could actually follow what's going on has made me realize what the solution is. I think that's wonderful. And that's the purpose of that kind of, you know, discipline, is to, you know, be able to walk, not just explain the problem to others, but explain it to yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we're talking about here when we talk about blogging for yourself. It's like you're trying to figure things out. And the process of figuring things out is telling a story to yourself first before you tell it to anyone else. And then once you have your story together, then you can actually explain in a coherent fashion to other people. Because I think a lot of unsophisticated programmers get to a problem. They're like, I got a problem and I don't know what to do. And, you know, I need the answer. It's like, well, you know, before you get there, before you get to like, I need immediate help, help yourself by structuring the problem. Give me the minimum reproductive case of your problem before you explain, you know, I have this problem, I don't know what to do. It's like, well, what's the minimum viable case that you can show me for your problem so that I can have your problem too, right?
Yeah.
And that's essential to debugging. That's essential to troubleshooting and anything else you're going to do as a programmer.
Well, when I talk to new programmers, I ask them how big their Scratchpad project spaces is, right? How many new projects have you created in general as you're trying to solve these problems? And if they never have, if they just keep on changing code in the same project, so they haven't created those minimums, that's invariably where you have to start. You know, is it my code or their code? Because I think it's very easy for us to go, that must be a bug in the framework or a bug in the operating system. It can't be me. It can't be me.
Right. Well, that's also what the origin of coding horror is. Coding horror, people think it's like this funny joke about, oh, coding is terrible, but it's not. It's actually an observation that you are your own worst enemy all the time. And that is critical to understanding how to be a programmer, is to understand you are public enemy number one to yourself all the time. That's what coding horror means. It's not that you're looking at other people's code and going, ah, ha, ha, your code sucks. No, you're looking at your own code and saying, wow, my code really sucks.
Yeah.
Right? And how can you prevent that for yourself? That's the key insight. That's what I loved about, of course, it's from the book Code Complete. But every time I saw that little sidebar illustration of the guy, like, oh my God, look at this code. It was like looking in the mirror.
Yeah.
You know, you're seeing yourself and saying, oh my God, I can't believe I did this, right? Because the computer is perfect. It does exactly what you tell it the same way every time. The imperfect part of the computer is the person programming it. That's the part you got to optimize for. And I think so much of the industry is about figuring out the person and the weaknesses and strengths of the person and the other people that are using your software, rather than is my code perfect? Code perfection is almost beside the point at some level. I mean, there's tons of projects that have gotten massively popular that had unbelievably bad code. They're just embarrassing, like PHP code. I mean, people forget that Facebook is really great at execution. I'll give them that. They're very, very good executors, which is critical. But Facebook was written in shitty PHP in 2004 on Windows XP. It was probably the nastiest code. I haven't seen it, but I'm guessing it was super nasty code.
Sure.
It wasn't like this beautiful, you know, love letter to computer science and you read in a cathedral. It was just a bunch of horrible PHP scripts somebody, like, you know, stitched together over time in MySQL. It wasn't like this testament to the power of computer engineering. Now, over time, they beat into shape. They come out with that language hack, which is like PHP, but like compilable.
Right.
So you can actually get performance. So they've done a bunch of stuff to fix that. But one thing you'll notice is that I complain about PHP on my blog a fair bit, and I feel bad about that because it is true. I mean, it's not like the Microsoft Basics I was writing in were not awesome computer science languages, but you get stuff done in them. But the beef with PHP is it was just designed by essentially nobody. Like, I think languages need to be designed by actual computer scientists because there's a lot of thought that goes into how a language works. It's like its consistency, its reliability, its design of, like, you know. The problem with PHP is that there's like these function names that make no sense. There's the MySQL escape, then there's the MySQL real escape, which also doesn't work. There's all these like design errors in the language, and it's like having a database designed by rank amateurs, right? Like, people are just sat down, like, I want to build a database because I'm bored. It's like, wow, that would be terrifying. We're an operating system, right? There's certain areas of programs where you can build Facebook in PHP. It doesn't really matter because you're going to evolve it over time anyway. But don't build the operating system that way. Don't build a database that way. Don't build a language that way. The core tools need to be built by people that kind of know what they're doing and have done this before. And PHP just reeks of somebody designed this who had never built a language before and never really thought about, like, where it was going, how it should work, all that stuff. So,
yeah. Well, that's part of the interesting thing is that you can probably look at the two most popular things sitting around right now. One is PHP and one is JavaScript. And neither of them were really well thought out, right? But they were approachable enough that they gained this great adoption.
Well, I would argue that the JavaScript was actually fairly well thought out. I mean, the person who built JavaScript actually had done this before.
Sure.
And had some training in actual language design. And there was thought put into it. And I think that's why JavaScript is reasonable today. And PHP is still kind of like recovering from the original train wreck it was at the start.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. Especially now that JavaScript is trying to evolve into solving some of the problems that were initially developed in the early prototypes.
Right.
Well, this has been great. I have one last question I'd like to ask all my guests, and that is, do you have any decision that you would love to reverse? I don't want to use the word regret as much, but, you know, I wish I would have looked at PCs before I did, or I wish I would have learned C when I was a kid, or whatever the thing is. Is there anything you would change?
I do, because I feel like for a long time, when I started with the Amiga, like, I didn't really like the command line. I found that I loved the GUI. I loved all the GUI-related stuff, but I hated the command line. And I never really looked at Unix, and I regret that deeply now because I feel like Unix has kind of taken over the world. Mm-hmm. And for good reason. I think by making the right decisions, ultimately long-term decisions that were better. I had this idea that Windows was going to take over the world, and I don't think that's true anymore. It hasn't been true for at least a decade or longer. So I regret not learning any form of Unix much, much earlier, and also not like coming to terms with the command line earlier in my life.
Yeah. And being
I do regret that. If I could go back in time and tell myself one thing as a kid, it would be, it's time to learn Unix, Jeff. because Unix, and it's been rock solid, right? Like, stuff you learned literally in the 80s, you could still be using in Unix. That's awesome.
Yeah.
We never see that in computers.
No.
Never. So it's like the bedrock of pretty much all modern computing is Unix and all the Unix utilities, all the way pipes, all that stuff, man. I mean, people are using VI for 30 years. or Emacs? That's crazy.
It is crazy.
And in a good way. I mean, I think that's a sign that Unix really got a lot of stuff right. They kind of won. I mean, open source is based on Unix, so that's what I would tell myself as a kid. Jeff, go learn Unix.
That's great advice. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. This has been just wonderful.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Thanks for listening to the Hello World Podcast. Remember, you can subscribe to the Hello World Podcast at hwpod.com.